Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and once again it's my privilege and pleasure to bring to you Mike Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics detective who over the years has struggled heroically against the intelligence community's involvement in the drug trade. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, my pleasure.
We've been talking about the Tyree case, a vitally important, albeit all very little discussed, or very seldom discussed case, and we've been talking about the fascinating persona of Albert Vincent Caron, who wore the hats of Army Colonel, CIA bagman extraordinaire, New York City detective, and also a made member of the Mafia. Now, Ferdinand, Albert Caron's daughter, came into possession of a letter, which was very fascinating, and which calls to mind some of the other names that we've talked about in this narrative. Tell us about that letter and how this may bear on the Tyree case, if you would.
Yes, I'm hoping to say that sometime after tomorrow, the 12th of July, I will be able to produce that letter and publish it, in effect, totally, not for everyone to see. D. Ferdinand and Ray Coleman, attorney for Bill Tyree, received anonymous mailings, which contained two letters. The first letter was a letter purportedly written by Richard Nixon, which talked about the commission of several illegal acts which were violations of federal law in the interests of national security and so on and so forth. The implication from these mailings was that these letters surfaced out of the Nixon library. Everybody who read that letter kind of, because D. Ferdinand, as a child through Al Caron, had been familiar with Richard Nixon. And Ray Coleman, through a number of other cases, had been very familiar with the history of Richard Nixon.
By the way, we might interject that Dick Nixon also touched on a lot of bases, including organized crime. His first congressional campaign was bankrolled by Mickey Cohen, the syndicate boss of Los Angeles, and managed by Murray Chotiner, who was one of Mickey Cohen's lawyers.
Yes.
And his connections with organized crime go back a long, long way. So it's that would not come as a surprise. And Ray Coleman was also familiar with Citizen Nixon as well.
Absolutely. So the first letter, the Nixon letter, people said was very interesting, but I'm not sure it's real. The second letter was on the letterhead of the Director of Central Intelligence. It was written in late 1985, at a period when William Casey knew that he was dying. 85 or 86, I'll have to check the date. I'm having a little brain fade there.
I think it's 85. By the way, it's interesting, speaking of his demise, that he also went out via brain disease, lingering brain disease, which didn't do much for his ability to communicate or recall.
Yes, it was written right before his death, and I will have that for you before I finish the statement. Anyway,
it says late 1986.
Okay, 86, that's right, because he died in here. I've got it right here in front of me. Thank you for the reference books, January of 1987, so that's correct. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In this letter, it's on CIA letterhead, and it's signed William Casey, Director of Central Intelligence. Now, I have had this letter read to me in its entirety, and I'm being deliberately evasive in some minor areas because this letter is stamped top secret, and it appears to be official. It certainly sounded real. D was unable to ascertain whether or not it was real, but it was enough to scare her. Ray Coleman was also of the opinion that it might be a very legitimate top secret document, and if so, if I knowingly divulge a top secret document in all of its entirety, so on and so forth. You understand what I'm saying? I have to be careful. I don't want to have them come and kick my door down and take my computer.
Are you in a position to discuss what you had said about it in From the Wilderness?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
If you could fill us in then on what the letter appears to be, and with whom established the apparent bona fides of the letter.
Yes. I wanted to set that up so your listeners had the benefit of understanding why I might sound a little vague. In the letter itself, William Casey describes it's a 2.5-page letter. And in it, Bill Casey describes his relationship with OSS during the Second World War and how he knowingly and freely violated many portions of the Geneva Convention during the Second World War. How he served the intelligence community of the U.S. for a long time and eventually became Director of Central Intelligence and knowingly engaged in the transportation of large quantities of drugs and narcotics and made sure that those drugs were protected and that it was done in an effort to fight communism, that it was done for the purposes of overcoming a reluctant, stupid, as he would call it, but he didn't use that word, Congress, who was standing in the way of the fight for freedom and to protect American interests and so on and so forth. And he quite freely admits in this letter at some length to dealing drugs and to doing all the things necessary to make sure that the drug dealing was successfully carried out, and that includes the cover-up of the drug dealing and all of its attendant crimes. And the letter is witnessed by Richard Nixon. And so when Dee got this letter and Ray got this letter, you know, Ray had, as an attorney for Tyree, had one course. Dee, being an untrained person, called me and said, geez, I got this letter. And I said, well, what is it? You know, she said, well, it sounds like Bill Casey. Now, remember, Bill Casey was at Dee's son's christening. She knew Bill Casey. Her mm-hmm. father knew Bill Casey.
Mm-hmm.
Her dad lived in Wantagh, Long Island, and Bill Casey lived in Locust Valley. And I always flipped those towns, but they were within miles of each other on Long Island. So I said, well, geez, it may be real. So Dee at that time said, I'll call Ted Shackley. I don't know what to do with this. I don't know if it's real. So she called Ted Shackley, again, mm-hmm. who was a retired associate deputy director of operations of CIA.
And one of the main figures in the U.S. intelligence community in the post-war period.
Absolutely. And he was also involved in Iran-Contra.
And a lot of these other related activities. Go ahead.
Yes. So she read the letter to Shackley, and Shackley joined everybody's opinion that the first letter just sounded kind of, you know, weird, maybe bogus, but the second letter sounded like it might be real. So he said, send it to me right away. She mailed it to Ted Shackley, whereupon, after receiving the letter, Ted Shackley called Dee back and said, you call right now the CIA and you call the FBI. You tell them that you have these letters, that you're not supposed to have these letters, and ask them to come pick them up immediately.
Obviously, that would seem to indicate that, at least to Theodore Shackley's mind, that the letter is, in fact, genuine.
Absolutely right. And what Dee did was, and I think it was a very smart move, she sent him certified return receipt back to her attorney, Ray Coleman, who sent them certified return receipt back to CIA and the FBI, along with the request that they be evaluated and respond. And this was 5 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
The letters first surfaced in January or so, late January. And of course, nobody has spoken a word about these letters since. Now, we are about on the threshold. This is why the hearing on the 12th becomes so important, is that the moment that a new trial motion is granted for Bill Tyree, to have the hearing on whether to grant a new trial, this letter, along with Dee's and Tommy's affidavits about Al Caron and other material we have discussed, will be entered into evidence. When it's entered into evidence in the motion for a new trial, then I can legally publish the letter, and I will do so, both on the website and in my newsletter.
Have there been any other developments in the Tyree case that you're in a position to talk about that we have not heard about?
Just a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuverings, a lot of lawyers' conferences and stalling and so on and so forth, with Ray Coleman digging in his heels and holding to the point and knowing that as long as he doesn't make any serious mistakes, the hearing will have to happen. So, no, there's been no major developments. The big thing on everybody's plate right now is the hearing for scheduled for the 12th.
Now, speaking of hearings, but I'd like to get to, we will get in just a minute, to some other lawsuits, class action lawsuits that have been filed in connection with the Contra-related drug traffic, and which obviously bear on some of the issues in the Tyree case. But one of the things that you've been talking about in your newsletter have been the scheduled hearings on Volume 2 of the internal CIA report. They turned out to be something of a surprise. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, we had put a lot of energy. We had hearings, the CIA had hearings on Volume 1 of the CIA's Inspector General report on the Contra drug trafficking, coming out of the Gary Webb story, the Dark Alliance stories. They held those hearings on March 16th of last year. That was Volume 1, and Volume 1 was the CIA's report strictly on Los Angeles and the Gary Webb allegations regarding crack cocaine dealer Freeway Ricky Ross, Danilo Blandón, Norwood Meneses, the Contra operation both in California and in San Francisco. There was some decent evidence in the CIA's Inspector General report, also a wonderful disclosure about a memorandum between William French Smith and Bill Casey, which basically allowed CIA to deal drugs and not report them. That's a smoking gun. But Volume 2 was the second part. It was the other shoe, which was 20 sizes larger than the first shoe, which was the CIA's look at the whole Contra war throughout North and Central America. and its report on the evidence that existed there. And we knew that that report had to be good because we had the Kerry report from 10 years ago with a whole bunch of damning revelations in it. And so we had been banking a great deal on an open public hearing. The Volume 1 hearing March 16th was held with no advance notice. It was not publicized. It was covered only on C-SPAN. Only by a stroke of luck and a good friend was I able to tape that hearing and get that on record. But we had been screaming, and readers of my newsletter, I know, had written more than 600-700 letters to the House Intelligence Committee, not counting the emails and the telephone calls, saying when you hold the hearings on Volume 2, you hold public hearings. And you cover them in the press, and you tell the people what you're talking about, because Volume 2, which had been released in declassified form on October the 8th of last year, was utterly devastating to the agency. It contained page after page of damning revelations of CIA knowingly working with guys who were caught with 400 kilos of cocaine and saying, I'm doing this for the NSC, and the headquarters in Langley saying, don't ask the guy any questions, and major traffickers on the level of Class 1 DEA violators, SETCO being one in Honduras, 4 tons of cocaine a month using bank accounts established by Oliver North. I mean, this report is devastating, and an open public hearing would have literally cracked the shadow government wide open.
Well, but we should stress that this is an actual internal investigation by the CIA itself, and it wound up being extremely damning to some elements of CIA and some of the people associated with the Contra effort, such as Ollie and George Bush.
Well, that's, you know, and of course, this is what I have scooped just about everyone on, and begrudgingly, even some of the most powerful names in journalism, Washington journalism, have acknowledged that I was right, is that Bill Clinton used this Volume 2 report to blackmail his way out of the impeachment. October the 8th, when it was made public, it was released and posted on the web 1 hour after Henry Hyde's Judiciary Committee started the impeachment inquiry.
Right.
So basically, Bill Clinton was saying, all right, if you're going to impeach me, I'll bring the whole government down. I'll show everybody that George Bush and Oliver North and all the Republicans were dealing tons of cocaine. And he won. And we have proof of that. I posted that in the newsletter on the website, that the Senate was reading my stories on that before they voted. But anyway, what happened with Volume 2 was we were hoping for a fair and open hearing, and they have to close it out. One of the reasons why they have to close it out is because Baby Bush is now running for president, and the presidential campaign starts in earnest in October, in the fall. And so this was an open issue, and it has to be closed out. Now, the House Intelligence Committee is chaired by Republican Porter Goss of Florida, who is himself a former CIA officer, believe it or not. And so we've been clamoring for open hearings. Now, they weren't even brave enough to put up on a schedule. They have a scheduling service which they announce on the web and which they publish, where they announce what they're holding hearings on, even if they're closed-door hearings. Well, May the 23rd, I believe it was a Friday, 22nd probably, they post like at 5 p.m. Washington time on the website that they're holding hearings the following Tuesday on CIA and drugs in Los Angeles. No notice given to anybody, not to Maxine Waters, not to me, not to anybody else. Now, that's misleading because Volume 1 was CIA and drugs in Los Angeles. So they hold a sudden hearing on May 25th.
With a deceptive title.
Yes, very deceptive title. Maxine Waters finds out about it, and she had been Clinton's ally in the impeachment, and she sends a letter over there by messenger, let me in, and they say no. They hold the hearings, and what nobody knew at the time, which I have since found out because they called me and they wrote to me, was that they heard from Michael Bromwich, who was the Department of Justice Inspector General, who had never openly testified, but then they heard from the CIA Inspector General and received and held the hearing on Volume 2 behind closed doors with no notice, and they didn't even have the courage to announce it to the public. Now, I got a call from House Intelligence about 10 days after that happened. And I had placed several calls saying what went on in those hearings, and they wouldn't tell me. Then they let me know, the assistant staff director, Tim Sample, and I published his letter in my the last issue of my newsletter from The Wilderness. And he said, well, yeah, we had the hearing on Volume 2, too. We just wanted to have it quietly. And this was all in connection with the fact that they are going to close the whole thing out and issue their final report sometime before the summer is over.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me to submit whatever other information I had. And, of course, I told them about now the Casey letter, which they should have to go check, because I will thoroughly embarrass the Congress if I produce this letter after they've closed it out and said there's no evidence or whatever. But I am really concerned. This was one of the most arrogant, underhanded, deceptive, dishonest things I have ever seen the government perpetrate. And it's scary for two reasons, Dave. Number one, because they did it, and number two, because apparently nobody caught it and nobody's screaming.
We have a little over 10 minutes left in this interview, Mike. A couple of things that I'd like to touch on in the last part of the interview. One sort of indicates what is at stake with regard to a full and impartial investigation of Volume 2 and the related activities. And namely, that's some of the disclosures or some of the theories of Catherine Fitz. We'll talk about her in just a second. And her theories about HU and crack cocaine and a number of other things, and also with regard to class action suits which have been filed, which could take information such as the type that Catherine Fitz has developed, such as the type that's in Volume 2, and such as you have developed over the years, and the information that would come out of the Tyree case, and could turn it into some serious winnings in court. First of all, Catherine Ann Fitz, bear in mind that we're limited for time. Who is she, and what did she have to reveal concerning HUD and crack cocaine and the politics of same, two things that most people would never equate with one another?
No. Catherine Austin Fitz is a former Assistant Secretary of Housing under George Bush in the Bush administration. She served for, I believe, 18, 19 months under Jack Kemp. Prior to that, she had been managing director at Dillon Reed, the Wall Street Investment Bank. She's an MBA out of Wharton, major Wall Street heavyweight investment banker player, also had been a very heavy Republican campaign contributor, organizer, working under Nick Brady in support of George Bush. That's how she got the appointment.
And by way of credentials, wasn't she also awaiting appointment as a director of the Federal Reserve?
She had been offered, after she left HUD, a seat on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, which she declined, yes.
The point is, this is not a flyweight.
No, this is a powerful, very intelligent woman. She left HUD for a variety of reasons, better to let her discuss those. She was not happy with the politics and many of the things she saw happening at HUD. In other radio interviews, she stated that she left just because Jack Kemp was asking her to do stuff that was illegal. She is a very strong proponent of place-based financing, equity-based financing, neighborhood, ground-up, grassroots management of the money, which she, as an investment banker, believes is far more profitable than the current top-down model. She's a big critic of the over-inflation of the current stock market. She became a consultant for HUD, working on place-based financing and full disclosure in 94, 95, working for Henry Cisneros, 96, who was nuked, horribly nuked, by the government.
Mm-hmm.
She was wildly successful. She had been the FHA administrator under Bush, and she was, as a contractor with her own investment bank, she was auctioning defaulted HUD mortgages back into the private sector, making billions and billions of dollars for the U.S. taxpayer.
And she found out something very interesting about the pattern of some of those HUD investments as it related to the whole L.A. crack cocaine case.
She created, incidentally, using people who were living in HUD projects, which is to her enormous credit. She was putting the jobs back among the people who were thought to be unemployable in the HUD projects, but she created these databases, and these unwed, unemployed mothers on welfare started working, but they created these databases which showed how the money worked. And one database was a database of defaulted HUD single-family mortgages, which she prepared for several cities, but one of which was Los Angeles. And she prepared a map of Los Angeles using these databases, which showed defaulted HUD home loans in South Central Los Angeles coming from the period when Ricky Ross was dealing the CIA's drugs. And if you look at this map, and if you're at all familiar with Los Angeles, it is absolutely, it hits you like a sledgehammer to see that there were thousands of defaulted home mortgages arising out of the 80s, which black middle-class people with $100,000 mortgages suddenly saw their homes worth $50,000. The jobs left. They couldn't keep the payments, so they walked on their homes. Somebody else bought all of these homes about 8-10 years later for 10 cents on the dollar,
mm-hmm.
which appeared to be a pattern of ethnic cleansing. And she had published this map for the first time at a Boston conference in the late summer of 1996, just weeks before the Gary Webb stories broke.
Again, she noted the pattern of HUD loan defaults on housing and the pattern of the distribution of the CIA cocaine by Freeway Ricky Ross, and came to the conclusion that the two were not in any way unrelated.
No, she says that they, well, she didn't at the time in 96, she didn't know.
Right.
But she was nuked immediately. As she started publishing this and started making this data available publicly just before the Gary Webb stories broke, and again, 96 was an election year too, she fell subject to the whistleblower treatment, which is all kinds of investigations, audits, smear campaigns in the press that put her company out of business, that subjected her. She had to spend millions in legal fees, and here we are 3.5 years later, and not one charge of anything, civilly, criminally, or anything, has been substantiated against her.
Mm-hmm.
She is now filing countersuits. All the criminal investigations have been dropped, but of course she's bankrupt now, or her company was. But she combined all of this, and it wasn't for a year or two that she started to hear about Gary Webb, and she didn't know about any of this. And then when she met me about 4 or 5 months ago, we put the pieces together, constructed a timeline. She was nuked because the cocaine shipments were being directed into South Central Los Angeles, and we have found documents, and I will be publishing more about this. And she is now a contributing editor to From the Wilderness, my newsletter. Going back to the Kerner Commission in 67 after the Detroit riots, which had participation from CIA and a number of defense contractors, which called for the spatial deconcentration of minorities out of inner cities because they were too economically and politically powerful, but they were felt to be a military threat to the government. So it was best to scatter them and diffuse them, out of the inner cities. And so as a result, their real estate has been gentrified and somebody's made billions of dollars in profits off of this.
Now, the cocaine and what you termed ethnic cleansing fits into this how?
The cocaine was the means used by which to introduce large quantities of crime, prostitution, drug trafficking, to drive down the real estate values, to drive jobs, employment, to depress the economy and destroy the neighborhood, so that the real estate values were depressed as people left their homes and defaulted on the mortgage, and they were laid fallow for a few years. Then somebody could come along years later and say, well, let's rebuild this area back up, but they bought these homes for 10 cents on the dollar.
So a lot of people made a lot of money, and basically with the crack cocaine allegedly used as an economic weapon, those neighborhoods were, in effect, ethnically cleansed, according to Catherine Austin Fitz's theory.
Absolutely correct. And you can look for this anywhere in the U.S. that you have seen a drastic pattern of African-American populations being displaced by either Asian or Latin American or white middle-class people bringing their money in and so-called gentrifying the areas.
It's a major phenomenon of urban life today. Mike, we've got about 5 minutes left, and we'll discuss Catherine Austin Fitz's theories and perhaps her travails at greater length in future broadcasts. You have been involved with some class action lawsuits, which obviously with the disclosures of Volume 2, with the potential disclosures of the Tyree suit, and now with some of Catherine Austin Fitz's theories looming in the background, the stakes are even higher, potentially, for those class action suits. Could you briefly tell us a little bit about those and distinguish, for the benefit of older and perhaps some more cynical listeners, or jaded might be a better word, why this is not these class action suits aren't a reprise of the Christic suit?
Well, the acoustic suits took a whole long period of time in using discovery and the RICO laws, which are very complicated laws, and they were seeking classified documents, and we took a completely different tack with the class action suits. I'd had this in my mind for a long time, and I've been studying CIA and drugs for 20 years, and basically I said, heck! Actually, I said a lot worse than that, but I said, heck! We already know right now, based upon the documents we have, this is Volume 2, and the Casey Smith Memorandum, which said CIA didn't have to report drug trafficking. We already know we have enough to prove. We don't need to subpoena any documents, but we also don't have to go to this huge conspiratorial case. We just have to say they didn't do their duty to report criminal activity and protect the interests of the American people. Let's file a suit. Let's file a class action suit on behalf of the American people using the documents that we have that are legal, that are admissible. And I fished around for quite a while and wasn't successful, but I eventually connected with two wonderful lawyers up in the Bay Area, Katya Komisarek and Bill Simpich. And I went up there to see them in late February. And I took my ideas and my documents with me, and Bill Simpich and Katya looked at it. They said, well, you know, this is the tobacco model. I said, what do you mean? They said the tobacco companies knew that tobacco was going to kill people. They had a duty to report that. They had a duty to put it out, and yet here we have all this proof that they covered it up. It's the exactly the same idea with the CIA. The CIA knew these drugs were going to kill people and destroy lives, and death was going to result. And not only did they not report it, they deliberately covered it up. It's the same model.
And by the way, as we were speaking on July 11th of 99, there was just within the past several days a monumental award to plaintiffs against the tobacco companies in those suits, in some of the class action suits that have been filed against the tobacco companies.
Same basic principle, and guess what? On the 13th, Tuesday, mm-hmm. in Oakland, at Oakland City Hall, the Oakland City Council, in a public session, is voting as to whether or not to join the lawsuits, to file their own separate class action lawsuit against CIA, or to hold a town hall meeting, or to do any one or all four of a number of different things in support of the suit, after the Oakland City Attorney, having reviewed the lawsuit, having concluded that, yes, there's a case here. This could be huge, because as Bill Simpich has correctly stated, if a number of cities sue the CIA, it is no longer ignorable, which is a great word, in the major media.
Mm-hmm. And this, again, will be on Tuesday, July 13th. For people who are listening to this program live and might have an opportunity to get some input to their council person.
Absolutely.
And so now, how from a position of law, well, we're almost out of time here, I think. Why don't we table an exact discussion of the principles of law involved here, and it was a more detailed discussion of the principles of law for a future broadcast. People are going to be wondering about how they can find out more, not only about the Tyree suit, about the Carone case, about Volume 2, about these the shocking handling of the hearings on Volume 2, about Catherine Austin Fitz and some potentially devastating theories that she has. And if any of that can be substantiated, that could have legal implications along the lines of what we've been witnessing in what used to be Yugoslavia in terms of ethnic cleansing. That situation's more complex. But your newsletter has been covering all of this and much more. And if people would like to find out about the class action suits, their status, etc., that's a good way of doing it. Give us the details again about your website and about the newsletter.
Okay. Again, it's From the Wilderness is the name of the newsletter. And the website is www.copvcia.com. copvcia.com. Or you can write to me, Mike Rupert, at From the Wilderness, at P.O. Box 6061-350 in Sherman Oaks, California, 91413. And I have a wide number of reports. I have a brand new videotape, which was recorded at Catherine Austin Fitz's mansion in Washington, D.C., just this last May, inside the Beltway, for a bunch of movers and shakers in D.C. who were very, very receptive. I have a whole list of products up there, and for your listeners, Dave, because I always have such a great time on your show, we've done many shows together,
mm-hmm.
if they mention that they are calling as a result of hearing it on your show and they subscribe to my newsletter, I will include four back issues for free, which will bring them up to speed on some of the more important topics we have discussed.
Indeed, by the way, speaking of Albert Caron, his brother had done some of the CIA LSD experiments, which are back in the news this week, and was also the chief psychologist or psychiatrist for the New York City Police Department.
Yes. Pat Caron Pasquale was a chief psychiatrist at NYPD, also a major New York State official in psychiatry with powers statewide for licensing, who was closely connected to MK Ultra, Sid Gottlieb, and all of our favorite buddies in that program.
And we'll be talking about that in weeks to come. For Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.